Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Everyone, welcome back to the show. My guest today is the Wall Street Journal's Dana Mattioli. She's in a book out today. It's called The Everything War: Amazon's Ruthless Quest to Own the World and Remake Corporate Power. This book is interesting because, unlike other approaches to Amazon, it's not purely focused on the Jeff Bezos rise to power story in the 1990s, 2000s, 2010s. Instead, it's focused on Amazon as a corporate phenomenon and taking that set of analysis to look at the antitrust debates that have really roiled the left, right, and center as we debate whether or not we should assume a different approach when it comes to assessing whether a corporation has too much power in the first place. She also focuses a lot on the current FTC chair, Lina Khan, whose initial rise to prominence rode on her writing an incredibly influential Yale Law Review Journal article back in 2017 when she was still in law school herself. So if you are someone interested in understanding modern antitrust debates, you can understand debates over corporate power. And finally, if you're someone who wants to understand the career of Lina Khan and where she's been and where she's going, all these are covered both in this interview and in the book. Highly recommended. Huge thank you to the Foundation for American Innovation for supporting the work of this podcast. Dana Mattioli, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me.
Great to chat with you. So we're discussing your new book, The Everything War: Amazon's Ruthless Quest to Own the World and Remake Corporate Power. Here is a very obvious question to ask you. I think out of all of the big tech companies, quote unquote, I'd say Amazon is probably the one that's had the most books written about it. You know, Brad Stone came on the show a few years ago to talk about his follow-up to the Everything Store. What specific angle are you taking on Amazon that's going to be a little different than the kind of typical origin story approach that a lot of companies and books have taken to it?
Yeah, it's a great question. So this is not a typical corporate biography or origin story. This book is an investigation into the company's business practices and a look into why the company tends to win a lot.
And what do you mean by win?
Well, if you look at Amazon's success in retail, but then in industry after industry after industry, it's gotten this unparalleled perch. It's the world's biggest e-commerce company. It's the biggest logistics company for parcel care packages in the US. It's the biggest cloud computing company. It's the third biggest digital advertiser. I could go on and on and on, which is sort of unprecedented. And the book gets into ways that the company has used the size and advantage to put their fingers on the scale and to benefit themselves.
Folks, in terms of what's new, especially for listeners who haven't engaged too aggressively in this topic area, I'd say the newest thing that you're analyzing is everything that you're investigating culminating in the 2023 FTC lawsuit. So what is this lawsuit that really anchors the end stage of taking all this in?
So the FTC sued Amazon in September and alleged that they're an illegal monopoly. And they basically said two major contentions: that because sellers know that they have to be on Amazon.com, where 40% of all e-commerce happens, Amazon has this enormous leverage with them, and they're able to levy all of these fees to the point where it's nearly 50%, 50 cents of every dollar a seller makes on Amazon goes to Amazon. And because of that, sellers have had to raise their prices to offset the fees, and that means that customers pay more. And that's the big crux of the FTC's lawsuit. But what's pretty remarkable about the lawsuit is they're saying that prices aren't just being raised for shoppers on Amazon.com. They're also being raised throughout the entire online economy in the US because Amazon has this asymmetric power in e-commerce, and it's also causing prices to raise on competitors like Walmart.com and Target.com because sellers have to have the lowest price on Amazon. So if you have to offset the fees on Amazon, you're also having to have that higher price elsewhere. And that's the crux of that lawsuit.
So what's really fascinating about that lawsuit, especially if you're someone who's followed the career of FTC chair Lina Khan and these debates about antitrust, is it's kind of getting at, and you can explain this better than I can, but there's been this long-running debate, especially in the 2010s, around like, how should we measure antitrust? Is it about the concentration within an industry, or is it about the actual impact on a customer? Typically, if we're looking at the traditional way we've assessed antitrust claims since the 1970s, the main lens of looking through it, it's Borkian, named after Robert Bork, who famously isn't able to make it into the Supreme Court in the 1980s. But it's this idea of like, does it harm consumers? yes or no. Traditionally, up until now, the perception's been, look, you could have all sorts of beef with Amazon, but like, look at everything you could get over Amazon Prime. Look at how convenient our lives are today. This is just clearly benefiting consumers, and all these other debate, political economy issues are just to the side of that. But in the way you articulated the lawsuit, the specific claim is actually that consumers and actual retailers are being harmed here. So within the context I just really set up here, get at the core of what's innovative about that legal approach.
This lawsuit's really fascinating because Lina Khan, the chair of the FTC, has railed against the Borkian consumer welfare standard, right? She and John Cantor at the DOJ and her school of antitrust thinking thinks we need to reverse the last 40 years of antitrust history where there was this reinterpretation as to what the law should achieve. It moved from protecting competition and competitors to looking at everything through the lens of consumer welfare or pricing, right? But when she brings forward this specific lawsuit, it's kind of Borkian. It's about consumer prices. And, you know, it's interesting in that respect. It also seems more careful than some of the other lawsuits that the FTC has brought forward under Lina Khan that had some like more novel legal theories that lost pretty publicly and were considered embarrassing for the agency. So there is some of this discrepancy in what was brought forward versus what a lot of the rhetoric out of this FTC has been.
I'd love for you to talk about what you just referenced in case folks don't know. So this idea that she comes in, becomes the FTC chair at a very young age, and then just very aggressively starts making these legal efforts that are thrown out or don't quite advance from a legal judgment perspective. Like, what is the core issue at hand there when you're using a term like embarrassing?
Lina Khan came into this agency, it was a surprise for many people, right? She's the youngest chair in history. She'd also been like very critical of the agency over the last few years for being asleep at the switch, for not holding these giant companies to account. So she comes in, shakes things up, gets off to a bumpy start because that rankles some people who feel criticized, right? And she starts, you know, setting a different agenda, as some people would say, to the point where there's some infighting at the FTC. One of the commissioners, Christine Wilson, famously leaves and writes a scathing Wall Street Journal op-ed as to why. She attests that Lina is trying to achieve certain social goals through the FTC rather than using the FTC's power the way it was, you know, written to be used, right? So she comes in and there are these two really big losses in the tech space that I think are emblematic of that. The FTC, under Lina's leadership, sues to block Facebook's acquisition of a company called Within Unlimited. And they use like a really interesting legal theory that they say that this acquisition would affect future competition, not current competition, and they lose. And that's pretty embarrassing for the FTC. They also sue to block Microsoft's acquisition of Activision, a you know big video game deal. They lose on those grounds too, which was another loss. And what's interesting about the FTC is that it's a very careful agency. They like to bring forward cases that they think have a high likelihood of winning. They like to make sure that they win because if they lose, you could hurt legal precedent. So people start getting a little bit frustrated about this at the FTC. It hurts morale. They have some of the lowest morale in recent years from it. And I would say, you know, when it came to the FTC's lawsuit against Amazon, which is a little bit of like a white whale, it's how Lina made her name back in 2017 when she was a law student. It's a different theory. They're not trying to reverse the last 40 years of history there.
I've been doing a lot of episodes on the TikTok divestment efforts. And I did a pro TikTok divestiture episode. I did an anti one where a libertarian lawyer was making these very like free speech centric arguments around the TikTok divestiture, believing it wouldn't be constitutional. And separate from your individual beliefs on the TikTok approach in the bill, I was just struck in that conversation by how much so many of the arguments hinged on, well, that could make sense at a principles level, but at a core level, the courts are going to say X, or the courts are going to say Y, or precedent dictates Z. And I found myself having that conversation just so sympathetic to Lina Khan's approach, in the sense that, once again, I'm not a lawyer, so this is probably why we have a system where we're dividing up expertise and focuses. I just found myself kind of thinking, okay, screw the courts. I just believe X, Y, and Z. Maybe we should just kind of try things. So I'm just curious what your, as an investigator, I'm just curious like what your opinion of that legal approach was. Because at a certain point, I think we could recognize that the courts and practice and precedent are all social constructions. Mm-hmm. So to a certain degree, I just found myself more sympathetic than I think one would typically be reading some of the negative coverage.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. When you read Lena Khan's like paper in 2017, she makes the case that the consumer welfare standard can't capture what's going on in the digital economy, where so much of what these digital giants is either free, like you don't pay to access Facebook or Instagram, right? Or was low prices like Amazon back in the day when it had the lowest prices, right? It was low prices, so it was abiding by the consumer welfare standard. But they would argue that because you're looking past those companies for low prices, you're letting other toxic, illegal behaviors go through, right? And I would say that her argument was considered radical just a few years ago, but it's gained a lot of momentum. It's this antitrust fight has the weirdest bedfellows. It's people like, you know, Senator Elizabeth Warren on the left and Matt Gaetz on the right, both believe in this. There are people on the right side of this argument that call themselves conservatives, like Lena conservatives, mm-hmm. right? But the bigger issue here, to your point, is what do the courts think? And it does take a longer time for these ideas to filter into the courts where a lot of these decisions are ultimately made.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I was at a dinner and I was with some like very smart kind of like masters of the universe types who work on Wall Street, and they were very pessimistic about the political system. And they were basically talking about like, look, like these politicians, these political appointees, they're not smart. They're not serious. They're not really engaged. And as I was reading your book and your characterization of whether or not you disagree or agree with Lena Khan, I found her actual political rise to be really fascinating from the perspective of like, actually ideas matter. There actually is like a marketplace. Actually, there is this environment of higher education where you could write a law review article and it really matters. So basically just talk about Lena Khan's rise and what that says about, I don't know, the fact that there really is an opportunity for intellectual entrepreneurship in our political system, despite the pessimism everyone kind of feels.
Yeah, I mean, she's had the most meteoric rise. And I think it's, to your point, it's really fascinating that what catapulted that career was a law review article. These articles are typically not very well read, or they're read by, you know, wonky academics, a small base of readers. What she did in 2017 went viral. You know, politicians read it. Ordinary people read it. Journalists grasped onto it. She had a glowing like New York Times profile after it, right? And it was sort of a lightning in a bottle moment because I think it tapped into this broader zeitgeist that was starting to form at the time about a tech lash. People were starting to question the giants that, you know, were often held up as this bastion of innovation, job creation, welcomed by the Obama White House. And the tide had started to turn. And I think her argument in the Yale Law Review was, you know, easy for people to understand. It helps that Amazon's also like a very well-known company where people are often getting boxes on their stoops every day. But it also tapped into some of what was happening in the background regarding that tech lash.
Yeah, I think what's interesting here, I would love to spend some time on kind of the way you tell the story of Amazon, because you very specifically refer to Amazon and this investigation that you're undergoing in the book, obviously, as a real means of understanding what happened to the American economy broadly in the 1990s. And I grew up in Portland, Oregon. So, of course, I thought of the Portlandia Dream of the 1990s song. And when you're really describing mall culture and strip mall culture and all these like different like economic developments that clearly shifted given the rise of the internet and digital commerce, my immediate question to you would be, to what degree was the end of that world inevitable, regardless of what Amazon was doing at a marginal level? In the sense that, okay, so let's say Amazon doesn't price things quite the way that they price things. A big box store that has 40,000 square feet and there's 10 of them within a broader metro area was probably not sustainable. So I'm just curious what the line between this world going away that I remember from childhood and just the fact that some things really were going to happen regardless of actual bad practice.
Yeah, I mean, some of this would have happened. Someone would have commercialized the online economy, no doubt. I think where Amazon's secret sauce is more that they were able to build this octopus with many different tentacles and become market leaders in each individual one. they're able to synthesize that power across industries where partners, competitors have no choice but to work with one, two, three of those tentacles. And that gives them the leverage. It's not just the retail side that gives them the power. It's they're able to synthesize across all these industries.
What you just said raises the question, what is Amazon? In the sense that, like, is it a conglomerate? Well, there are actually a lot of conglomerates, and conglomerates don't inherently take over all these different industries. If we think about the way we told the Amazon story, we talk about how Barnes & Noble and Borders like really missed the mark. But it's hard to imagine a world where Barnes & Noble or Borders are better when it comes to understanding online digital commerce. And also imagining a world where all of a sudden Borders has like a movie studio. So there's just something bigger here. I'd love for you to talk about that, because just summing this up as Amazon, there's something that unites these things together in a way that no one else has really pulled off.
Yeah, that's right. I think, yeah, they are 1,000% a conglomerate. I think Jeff Bezos would hate that word, but it is what they are. And they became one at exactly the time in corporate America where that structure went out of vogue, where other companies could not make it work. The activist investors came knocking and said, hey, GE, what are you doing being in healthcare, airplane turbines, making all these different manufacturing processes? It's dragging down your stock price. Spin these things out. And they did. Same thing happened to United Technologies. All of these companies right-sized and became standalone businesses. But Amazon spun up this giant conglomerate, and it hasn't hurt their stock price. They've been able to do this in a way where even though some parts of the company could be pretty siloed, other parts stand to benefit from having that much access to data, having that much leverage. And we tell stories in the book where, you know, that access to data across the tentacles really gives it an edge. Like if you look at their M&A or their venture capital arm, and then their devices business and the types of meetings they were taking there, right? Where it just gave them insight into some of the most cutting edge technologies coming out of competitors. I think that says a lot.
And this is why, you know, I'm curious. So what I love about your book is that you're really, especially the way you framed the beginning, telling the story of the past 8 to 10 years of antitrust debates through the lens of Amazon. I'm curious about the difference between covering the antitrust debate through the lens of Amazon versus, for example, Meta. Because I think the difference that I would just say as a layperson would be, if we're telling the story of Meta's relationship with antitrust, it's about acquisitions. So Meta is allowed, then Facebook is allowed to buy Instagram. It buys WhatsApp. It buys Oculus. That one, you know, that one's sort of like unclear where that one's going. Not to be negative, but that one's like not quite the same slam dunk. But the point is, it's about they have all this money, they have all this leverage, and they purchase things versus Amazon. Amazon didn't buy Amazon Prime. Amazon didn't, I mean, there were talks for Amazon to have a relationship with Netflix, but Amazon builds its own DVD unit that eventually turns into Amazon Prime. Talk in terms of the Prime Video, talk about the differences between covering this issue between a Facebook acquirer and a Amazon that has the ability to actually spin up these internal units that are but aren't related at the same time.
Yeah, that's a great distinction. Amazon largely spun up these individual businesses that some of them would rank as some of the top companies in the world, probably by sales or market value, if they were spun out on its own, for the most part. And I think what's fascinating about their ability to do that speaks to how they train the stock market to value them differently than other companies. They have this enormous long pass from Wall Street about not having to show a cent of profit for years. And that allowed them to invest, take money from one business and put it into another. So a lot of the companies that you see now, or the divisions within Amazon that are giant, took years. I mean, Jeff likes to say that his overnight successes take 10 years to develop because they have extraordinary patience in ways that other public companies cannot have. And I would say a lot of other public companies don't have the cash being spun off from like a cloud computing business to help bolster them up and set up different arms of them, of their businesses. Amazon has done some acquisitions over the years. That hasn't been their main strategy, like a Facebook, to your point. But when they do, we have, you know, I think a whole chapter dedicated to this. They do have a lot of leverage because they're one of the top companies across industries, and that gives them a lot of access to proprietary data from their rivals.
What does it mean to train the stock market to kind of understand the strategy that you're describing here, because the sentence you said is very simple. But if you actually think about it, like every single company that's public would die to be able to do the same thing. Like GE in the 1990s would die for the ability to convince the stock market, the market, et cetera, that actually the way we're constructed actually makes sense. So like, what does that sentence mean? And how did Amazon actually do that incredibly difficult thing, despite how simple that sentence sounds?
Yeah, this is one of the really fun parts of the book for me. So when Amazon IPO'd in 1997, they, on their roadshow, trained their analysts not to look at the losses, but to look at the growth opportunity. That sounds standard now. A lot of companies IPO without profits or definitely without EBITDA. That was novel back then, especially for retailers, right? So to have that bandwidth to just invest and grow and take market share was just kind of unheard of. And when I spoke for the book for the retail CEOs of other public traded companies during that time period in the 90s, early 2000s, they just said, you can't underestimate what that meant for competition. These CEOs couldn't fund having warehouses for online commerce because their board members wouldn't give them enough money to have e-commerce operations because it would hurt their quarterly earnings. So they had to underinvest in their own e-commerce footprints when Amazon was able to plow all their money into innovation and growth. Mm-hmm. And it just started this game of trying to play catch up that just only got the delta just got wider and wider over the time. They just couldn't catch up.
You know, speaking, this is directionally newsy, but I've been fascinated the past few years to kind of see, at least it feels like a lot of the hype and literal impact in the real world around Amazon's like we're going in person, the bookstores, the, you know, automated checkout. What do you kind of think has happened there? And to what degree does their struggles to translate their strength in the warehouse to digital, to the in-person affect the regulatory, view of this sort of company?
You know, I think it's indicative of the fact that this company is not afraid to take big bets, to make mistakes, to have risks. I think physical stores is an example of that where they haven't succeeded. There's a view at Amazon from top leaders that you can't be like this giant retailer without having a grocery footprint. And most people still like to buy their groceries in store. So I think that's prompted part of it. But they're able to build out these giant experiments within the company, spend a lot of money and shut them down pretty seamlessly without really taking a dent to their stock price. And I think that says a lot. There's a lot of confidence. There's a lot of confidence in this company, even when they have rare misses. You know, when they do enter a space or there's rumors of them entering a space, which is like pretty fascinating to me, is the stock market immediately reacts. So if they file a patent in a certain space or there's a report that they hired someone from a different sector, what you'll often see throughout history is the rest of those competitors in the spaces, their stock prices dive. Wall Street's made a bet that Amazon's going to come in and really disrupt you.
You know, something I'm curious about, one of the ways, going back to the TikTok reference I made, that this era of regulation and regulatory scrutiny has clearly changed the game, is now everyone by default said, look, let's say TikTok is divested from ByteDance. Obviously, Meta will not be able to acquire TikTok, just because the presumption is there's no way the courts, the FTC would let that through. I'm curious, to what degree has the real regulatory scrutiny towards Amazon impacted their ability to take these big swings or like actual actions they've taken as a company?
Well, I'll give you a scoop from the book. I don't think it's impacted their ability very much at all. The company has been under scrutiny the last few years, started in Europe. We were a little bit late to regulating our own companies where, the EU was really looking at their business practices, and then the UK, Italy, all these countries started opening investigations. And then the FTC files their suit last year. In light of all this pressure, Andy Jassy, now the current CEO of Amazon, has recently told his top executives that we could be a $10 trillion company. You know, they're about $1.5 to $2 trillion today. So they think they're not nearly big enough. And so I don't think this is really impacting their outlook, their businesses, their decisions to grow. They see a lot of white space.
So help me understand this from an antitrust perspective. So if we're looking at the specific selling policies and relationships with third parties on the platform that you referenced in the FTC's lawsuit. Obviously, that matters at a monetary level, but that doesn't seem to me to be what would really swing whether or not Amazon could go from 1.5 to 2 to $10 trillion in actual value. So where, from a legal, consumer, citizenship standpoint, does Amazon's ambitions start to run up against the law in that category? Because it's not as if, do you kind of what I mean? Like is there a reason why Amazon, well, why we should be skeptical of Amazon wanting to get that big, I guess is the question I'd ask inherently.
Like their ability to do it, you mean? Or
yeah, so I guess the better way to phrase this is just, if I'm thinking about this, maybe put it this way, I'm trying to understand how we're considering the example of Amazon when it comes to their ambitions. Because like, once again, when it comes to Facebook, Facebook's an easier company, I think, to think through, because it's like, okay, part of Mark Zuckerberg's strategy is clearly acquiring these current or soon to be competitors. So if we're concerned about his corporate power, his control of the market, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the metric is block those acquisitions. No, Mark, you have to figure out yourself given your current resources. Amazon, by contrast, whether we're talking about Lena Khan's lawsuit in 2023 or these acquisitions, I would wager, and this is probably what Wall Street's wagering too, has the ability to get from 1 to 2 trillion to 10 on its own.
Yeah.
So how do we think about the antitrust case against its power given that context? Because that's what I'm struggling to ask the question articulately, because it seems to be, it seems like it's just this fundamentally unique case because of some correct gambles that Jeff Bezos got together from the start.
Yeah, it's not like blocking a merger is going to deter them from growing in size and getting to that $10 trillion mark, right? Because a lot of times they've spun up their own businesses. And you think about it, in the next few years, they have some really big ones launching. You know, they have a project they've spent a lot of money on called Kuiper that's going to be a Starlink competitor with Elon Musk. That's going to launch in a few years. That opens a lot of revenue streams. They have recently launched a logistics service that not only ships products from Amazon.com, but they want to take other retailers' inventory and ship it for them as like their logistics program, right? So competing more directly with UPS and FedEx. They've just started to really gain traction in the healthcare space, one of the biggest areas by GDP in the US. We'll see what happens there, right? So even if the lawsuit from the FTC is successful against Amazon, A, it's really narrowly focused. Like if there were to be a breakup of the company, which there's some language in the complaint that signals that that might be what they're angling for. Based on what the lawsuit looks like, it looks like it's more about like their logistics arm. It wouldn't go after any of those other companies I just mentioned or other businesses within Amazon I just mentioned. It's really narrowly focused. So I don't know how you stop it from growing in that way.
This case very specific. And this is why Amazon is the fascinating company to look at this. At a broad level, beyond these specific legal or regulatory bad or moral decisions Amazon makes, like what do you think Lena Khan or like new antitrust advocates would say is the problem of Amazon getting to $10 trillion in value, given that this isn't like the AT&T monopoly where we had a very, like, I wasn't alive for this, but as I've read, where there was a very adversarial relationship between their corporate power and the actual like consumer. In this case, it's like, okay, you know what? Like, honestly, if I'm not thinking politically, a $10 trillion Amazon, man, One Medical is probably going to be even better. Whole Foods is going to be even better. Prime's going to have like, I'm getting a bunch of like same day shipping for a bunch of products. Like, what is their case against that big size separate from individual things like maybe their pricing power? Maybe they shouldn't have the off label goods listed next to their competitor goods. How do you think about the way they articulate that case?
Well, two things. If they were to become a $10 trillion company, that's by far the biggest company in the world. And if they are deemed an illegal monopoly now at the size they are, the tactics they would probably use to get to $10 trillion might be deployed as well. And then also, you know, it's those dollars have to come from somewhere. It's a zero-sum game. So if Amazon's growing and getting that much bigger, where is that coming from? What does that mean for the competitors in the space? And it kind of goes back to the pre-Borkian days where you have to look at what does that mean for the competition, not just for the pricing.
Oh, that's really fascinating. I want to talk about this then for a second. To what degree... to what degree do you think this actually is a zero-sum game? for example, I'm sitting at my desk and I have just like a bunch of Amazon products that I've ordered. So I've got like a special Elgato monitor so I could like look directly at you instead of just doing that awkward Zoom camera thing. I've got my Shure boom arm. I've got all these different things. And I honestly, I'm not sure I would have purchased them if I had to go to a big box store and it wasn't as easy to find things. So like, how do you think about this idea of there being a zero sum game, or there's something like the internet, which creates value. You could find things you think about differently. Like, how should we think about that? I'm just curious, like, for you to unpack how you think of as a reporter, this idea of whether or not there's a zero sum game, because that's an incredibly politically fraught topic in other contexts, as you could no doubt guess. Like, okay, like, does economic growth like lift all boats? Or does it create new opportunities? Or is it redistributing from the poor to the rich, et cetera? How do you think about this zero-sum game in the context of the internet then?
I mean, you sort of said it yourself. You have a boom mic in front of you, a special screen. You're not going to go and buy a second one of those at B&H in Brooklyn or or Best Buy, right? Like the customer chooses where they're going to buy something. And that's part of what some of the regulators are looking into also, is that Amazon, there's 200 million people that have Amazon Prime throughout the world. And it sort of trains you to shop with them, right? Because you get the free shipping, but then you also get the videos, and it becomes this ecosystem that becomes pretty sticky. And once you're in that ecosystem, there's evidence that you spend a lot more money with Amazon, but that comes at the expense of other rivals. That means you're spending less on your own Main Street probably, or even at the big box competitors to them, or, you know, with other streaming services. It has to come from somewhere.
You know, I feel obligated to say this because I feel guilty now that you brought up B&H. So B&H is this great New York City audio, video, everything you could imagine. They have a great store in downtown Manhattan. Whenever I buy something, I usually check if B&H stocks it, because I like trust their judgment. And then I honestly probably buy it on Amazon. So this is a free non-sponsored advertisement for B&H, given the guilt that you just elicited in me. I think that kind of gets, and I guess this is actually another question too that I wondered. So when you were, you're recounting the early story of Amazon, and it's talking about how like early Amazon, there was a gap between the like relentless, like very aggressive Jeff Bezos and the perspective of some of the early employees. And it specifically mentions a bookshop that one of those early employees in Seattle feared would be taken out of business, given like what they were able to do, even in the early stages when it came to bookselling. But that store still exists. The Portland equivalent obviously is Powell's. A lot of cities have their own equivalents. What from your personal experience distinguishes a circuit city that can't survive Amazon from something that still can? How do you kind of think about that dynamic?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And the booksellers were definitely the canary in the coal mine. And it's nice to see that Elliott Bay, the Seattle one, and Powell's and the Strand in New York still exist. I think what they're doing is they're offering something experiential, and they have like a real connection with their customers. But even in situations where retailers are doing everything right like that, there's an example in the book, this British bookseller, and she wanted to own a bookstore her whole life, and she was a staple of the community. Harry Potter release comes out, and she chartered this old steam train, and all the kids in the village came with their parents, and they dressed up as, you know, warlocks and wizards. And she hired all these drama school actors and had owls and, you know, magicians on the train. And they went to this midnight release party to get their books on this river. And she made it so magical. And she did stuff like this. She did, you know, midnight candlelight readings around Christmas with the community. She baked cakes for the moms and their toddlers to go to, you know, story time every week. She was a staple of the community. But there comes a time for some of these businesses that even though they're a staple, that the economics just don't work out anymore. And in the example that I just mentioned of that bookseller, her name's Anna, you know, she slowly saw the decline of her revenues, and she was paying herself very little in the beginning to begin with, because this was a labor of love, and it dwindled from like 1,200 pounds a month to 1,000 to 750. She starts boarding up some of the shelves because she can't afford inventory anymore, and turning the spines outward to take up space. And, you know, and then she finally had to close shop a few years ago, and she remembers her shoppers coming in for the weeks leading up to it, just in tears, crying, like, you can't do this to us. You can't leave. And she's like, you know, you come in take pictures of the book and buy them on Amazon. How am I supposed to compete with that, right? So I would say like the bookstores do occupy a special space in a lot of communities. But, you know, if you just look at the hard data, the numbers, they've dwindled, right? Even if they have offered the experiences. Sorry, did that answer your question?
No, it does, because it gets at... It gets at the, because I was just asking for like your personal reaction to it, because you can kind of make the case both ways, because in many ways you could say, look, Strand, Powell's, et cetera, have proven that if you just have a unique identity and a unique brand, you really work on the in-person experience, it goes both ways. Like sometimes that doesn't work, as in the example you gave. So it's hard to kind of find a perfectly tried and true example. So, you know, two or three last big questions here. Here's what I'm super curious about. So as you stated, there's a bit of the antitrust like political coalitions here are interesting. So for example, at this point, I genuinely think like the election in November 2024 could go either direction. So Biden, Trump, if I'm Meta and Facebook, I wouldn't expect the regulatory environment to change for me that much, regardless of who wins. I think that TikTok is going to get divested eventually. And if it does, it doesn't matter if Trump or Biden are in the presidency, Meta's not going to be able to acquire it. With Amazon, though, it's kind of interesting. Like, it's unclear to me that some of these Lena Khan arguments have, I think, penetrated the intellectual firmament quite to the same degree as the Facebook Meta acquisition issues. And even when Donald Trump says negative things about Jeff Bezos, like, it's very personal. I don't think Donald Trump, I think Donald Trump, given like a variety of proclivities, does have, and the conservative movement broadly, has a lot of sympathy with the antitrust case against Facebook, because it directly has to do with speech and control over speech. You don't have to like remake the conservative perspective on a bunch of like market issues to convince someone to be skeptical of acquisitions. When it comes to Amazon, though, the case is like much more complicated. The market-oriented side has more power. Let's say Trump wins. Lena Khan isn't there. Obviously, Josh Hawley has been sympathetic to Lena Khan type arguments, but where do you kind of, and J.D. Vance as well too, where do you see this going in terms of the Amazon side of things at a perception? You obviously can't predict the cases, but, you know, do some free corporate PR for Amazon or some free, you know, government relations work for them. How do people see these things swinging if the election goes either
way? Yeah, it's kind of a lose-lose situation for Amazon. The Trump White House, there was so much negative rhetoric from Donald Trump against Jeff Bezos, The Washington Post, and Amazon. And I spoke to a lot of his senior aides for this book. And Peter Navarro, I said, you know, the president was obviously really concerned about Amazon. Why didn't you try to do the things that President Biden has done? You know, appoint someone like Lena Khan, do an investigation. He said, oh, we would have gotten around to that in our second term. We'll see. Mm-hmm. And you know, I spoke to Anthony Scaramucci recently, and you know, he was famously the White House press secretary for like 10 days. And he said within his like first day, President Trump called him into his office and said, how do we break this company up? We've got to do something about them. Right. So he was focused on Amazon. I don't know if it was just for the Jeff Bezos, you know, personal animus reasons, or if he had like a gripe with the Washington Post's coverage. But then when you look at the Biden administration, which Amazon was like pretty confident that they'd have better relations with. They had Jay Carney, mm-hmm. that they brought over from the Obama administration to be the head of government relations and public affairs. Biden's been less outwardly critical of Amazon, but his administration has had teeth when it comes to regulating them. He handpicked Lena Khan to run the agency regulating them. He is aligned with her vision of antitrust and John Cantor's vision. He thinks that we need to go back to a pre-Borkian version of these things. And he's made Jeff Bezos persona non grata at the White House. They couldn't get a meeting with Biden to save their life because the Biden administration viewed them as too toxic. So I don't think this is a great election for them either way, to be honest.
Does Jeff Bezos, obviously Jeff Bezos matters on 15 different levels, but from an Amazon perspective, does he still matter? right? He's in Miami. So if you're thinking about like the, does the personal animus still matter? Right. In the same way that like, it's not how, like, obviously Bill Gates is going to always matter when it comes to Microsoft, but like telling the story of Microsoft through the lens of Bill Gates becomes increasingly irrelevant as you move away from his leadership of the company. How do you think of Jeff Bezos? Cause both founders, same thing with Zuckerberg at Meta, are so, they're, personalities are so like tied into the companies that in many ways their successors really struggle in the immediate future. How do you think about Bezos's relationship to Amazon as it moves? Because here's the thing, the crazy thing too, and this is why I think your reporting is so fascinating. A $10 trillion Amazon, that almost has nothing to do with the Amazon in 1997. In terms of like, so how do you think about Bezos to Amazon? How long do these things stack together? I think they clearly still do, but I kind of wonder, given the scope of ambition you're talking about here, how long does that continue?
Yeah, I mean, you have to remember, Bezos is still executive chair. So he's still involved at the board level, big decisions. And I think even though he's like largely checked out from the day to day, he has created this cutthroat, succeed at all costs culture that persists at the company. And I think, you know, when we get into some of the anecdotes in the book of the more problematic behaviors that could be deemed anti-competitive, it derives from that Machiavellian win at all costs culture. So even though he's not there walking the halls every day, that exists, that persists.
So here is the final question. I just had this thought just reading your introduction, which I really, really, really enjoyed. You're talking about the world of the 1990s, as I mentioned earlier, the world of going to the mall and all of the big box stores, but also kind of like the small, like generics that you would see at any American mall. And you combine that with the skepticism that a lot of folks early on had towards Jeff Bezos and the ability of Amazon to transform the internet. How does writing that history make you think about prospects for AI to be truly transformational? In the sense that if you really think about it, and crypto people made this argument, I was always skeptical of it, but I think it's reasonable to state that there's a convincing case that we could understand this early era of AI as being equivalent to the 1990s. Like, even if you could point out all these different flaws, you could say this, 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 or that, but what really mattered, and this is what Jeff Bezos understood about the internet, you can poke holes in individual specific issues. It could be bad use cases. I love the example you gave of people would call to phone in their orders because they didn't like the credit card. Okay, they read it over the phone, they hang up, call back to customer support. Okay, did it actually ship? And then just on and on and on and on. You could point to those experiences and say, oh man, like, obviously I'm going to choose Barnes & Noble over that weird experience. But I also am aware, though, at the same time, that we could weaponize people getting Amazon wrong to be overly bullish on AI. Because I think you saw a lot of crypto. I'm not sure how much you talked to crypto founders, but my favorite category were crypto founders who were kind of like in my age category, who would say things like, well, to everyone who's skeptical of crypto's ability to transform the internet, recall the Barron's cover that was skeptical of Jeff Bezos and Amazon. And that's what I mean by, like, you're weaponizing Amazon's experience, where it's like, okay, like, come on, like, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So how do you just like think, I just, this is like, yeah, a long, I this like is just that. Like a thought I've had, but I just would love to close with your reaction to mm-hmm. this. Cause I was just thinking, like, how does this rhyme? How does it not rhyme? And how do I not like become overly bullish on someone pitching a future case knowing what we know now?
That's such a fascinating question. I would say that when Jeff was starting Amazon, you know, I think 3% of people in the US even had a computer. They didn't want to, they didn't understand what online shopping was, and they were scared to put their credit card number into the abyss. This was like definitely an against a lot of success story. There was definitely more naysayers about e-commerce than you see about AI right now. So it seems like the people around AI are much more bullish, like kind of akin to the crypto people. So mm-hmm. I don't know if that's like a good omen for them or a bad one, to be honest. But that's funny. I never heard of I hadn't heard of the crypto people invoking Jeff's Barron's.
Oh, they love it. This is part of the like media versus tech dynamic. People love invoking the Barron's argument. And on the face of it, it's a fascinating anecdote. Like, I always think, man, poor guy, you know, at a certain point as a journalist, you have to have takes, you have to write articles, and you just know in his personal life, he's going to always know I was the person who wrote the Barron's cover saying, okay, Jeff Bezos, enough. That's always going to be, it's going to be in the obituary, obviously. But I'm always just kind of like fascinated by like, how do we, you know, because I'm in a quasi-journalistic role, like how do we be skeptical of things while also being open to actually sometimes you could tear something apart too much and miss the big picture. And I think that's what Jeff Bezos, I think that's what in many ways Elon Musk, and that's what Mark Zuckerberg got right. They got those early things. So finding a way to balance those two without being overly laudatory is a very difficult point. So this has been really fun, Dana. The book is The Everything War, Amazon's Ruthless Quest to Own the World and Remake Corporate Power. Thanks for joining me on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.